Last night was just wonderful. I'm sure you all feel so. I was particularly thrilled to hear how such a beautiful, such a big choir, and such a wonderful orchestra. Everybody playing in tune, wow. And but with real feeling, I have to really hand it to all of you, and especially to David Eby for his work with all. The music last night made me think, I've thought for years about it, because it obviously isn't classical music, it isn't pop music, it isn't easy listening music, it isn't, what is it? It's something totally different, and I certainly don't want it known as Kriyananda music. The less my name has to be tagged to it, the better, because we're talking of principles, not persons. But it occurred to me, meditating on it, that perhaps the best description of it would be clarity. This is what, because first of all, I used to sort of regret slightly that the expression soul music had already been preempted. But you know, it isn't soul music anyway, because it's how do you put, I mean, you put this come chill and wake up. Under soul music, you can't. Music of the spirit, it really isn't, let's face it. Nor are a number of the other songs like Little Kathy and so on. They're all about values, yes. But they're about many other things, some of them just for fun. And like the cherry blossoms in Kyoto and different things. I've really covered an extremely broad gamut. And I guess if I look back, I have to see that I've been led without knowing that I was being led. I've done these things not knowing, well, why am I doing it? But there I felt impelled to do it. And I see now that this is really the essence of what we're doing and what our path is. If you look at what Master brought, Yogananda brought to the world, he's different in many ways from many of the more austere yogis like Ramana Maharshi, no matter what you asked him practically, he'd say, ask yourself, who am I? Who's doing this? That's not Master's way. That was certainly not his way, but he was so much more than that. The ways of these different masters, each one is unique, and it's so wonderful to see it because everybody wants to sort of put them in a little box and say, stay there, be a good doggy. And the fact is that they're all themselves. When you come to know yourself, even though what you know is yourself in God, he's unique in every one. But different ones come with special purposes. And Yogananda's purpose really was unusual. He came to sort of launch this new age of energy. Now, we think of energy as... I know when he said... He had the ashes of Mahatma Gandhi that somebody had sent over from India, and he had them in a little shrine, and he wanted people to come and feel the vibrations. There were a couple of these little teenagers, about 15 years old, and I heard them leaving there. One of them laughing said, I didn't feel no vibrations. He didn't even know what I meant by vibration. I guess he thought that, you know. But we tend to think of energy a little bit like that too, but it's a lot more. It's a vibration. And Master brought these teachings down to such a practical level, but I began to describe it yesterday in such a way that will help us to really understand what it's about. Clarity. He brought clarity to everything. Well, not the kind of clarity that Sherlock Holmes showed. Mystery stories are very popular. People like to figure out who done it. And... you can always usually tell, Agatha Christie's the best one in this respect, because you can always see that the one it can't possibly be is the one who did it. But that's mental. What he did was bring clarity of heart. Real understanding, as I said yesterday, the consciousness, and that's understanding, is fourfold: mind, intellect, ego, feeling. But it really begins with feeling. Without feeling, there isn't real understanding. You can have the understanding of somebody who can work, break codes and work out puzzles and things like that, but that doesn't make him wise. You'll find that the people who are in the so-called genius IQ range, very few of those people on the highest IQ levels have ever made a success of their lives. One of them that I knew of was a watchmaker, another was a plumber. That's not the key to success. The key to success is clarity of understanding, and understanding in itself seems like a passive thing, but feeling brings in also impulse. Master defined willpower as desire plus feeling directed toward fulfillment. People who just can feel, apart from the fact that most of them don't feel right, but if they do, it still isn't enough. Passively to perceive is not what this age is all about. I'm not saying it's wrong in itself, but this, the energy of this age, the vibration of this age, is an impulse toward a new kind of achievement that includes the feelings of the heart. And that's why the arts are so important. Feeling begins in the heart. Feeling needs to be directed toward the point between the eyebrows, beyond the intellect. It needs to be directed through the intellect, however, as Yogananda said, that devotion needs to be kept in a state of reason or it becomes emotional. Now, there's the problem with feeling altogether. Most people feel things, but they feel them on an emotional level. Emotion means likes and dislikes, ups and downs. You feel great one day and down the next. I love this and I hate that. You don't ever get clarity that way. That's why scientists say exclude your feelings when you're trying to do something. But really, you have to have feeling, and great scientists do. It's absolutely wonderful. In the recent Clarity magazine, Ken Atwell wrote a beautiful article, very well written and very well done, on the life of Luther Burbank, in which he felt the flowers. He had an uncanny ability to feel which flower would flourish and which wouldn't. He would go down a line of vegetables and say, keep this one, destroy this one, keep this, destroy that. And out of a lot of them, he would keep a few and throw the rest out. And a friend of his said, well, how do you know? He said, I'd rather than see these destroyed. Let me have them. I'll try to do something with them. So he took them and planted them. They didn't grow. Whereas the ones Burbank had said would grow, did grow. Well, this was, of course, the great objection of scientists to Luther Burbank's work. They couldn't replicate it. He had more than just analytical ability. He could commune with the flowers. He could feel something. Now, that's something you can't get in school. And true creativity of any kind, true artistry, you can't get it in school. How many thousands of graduates are there from art school every year? And how few go on to become good artists, what to speak of great ones? And most of the great ones never even bother to learn, because the real understanding comes from inside. And this is true in all fields. Some man that I heard about, there was a friend of a friend, he, when he got retired and so on, he decided he'd finally go to college. He'd not got through grade school. He hadn't had time. I forgot what reasons he had. It may be that his parents died and he had to support the rest of the family, whatever it was. Anyway, he went to college, and at his age and with his lack of more than grade school education, the professors, the authorities, were very reluctant to allow him in. But they knew what a great success he'd had in his field, and so they moved heaven and earth to get him accepted at a college level. And after a few months, he came in and said to them, I don't want to go any further. And they were just really offended. They said, we've put so much effort into getting you in here. What's the matter? He said, look, the professor I have in this subject, I taught him everything he knows. The professor I have in that subject, I'm the one who taught him. He said, these two people don't know anything that I didn't know and give to them. They became professors, but he was the real professor because he'd learned it in the College of Hard Knocks. Now that's real education. And that comes from another level of understanding. That kind of clarity begins with clarity of heart. It's not enough to have clarity of mind. Clarity of feeling is absolutely necessary. In the heart, which is the center of feeling, you find two potentials. One is that it goes outward. The other is that it goes inward. And you know the heart is really this spurt of energy in the spine. It creates that energy in the spine. It directs it either upward or downward. When it goes downward in the spine, it goes outward to the senses. When it goes upward, it goes up to the spiritual eye and into superconsciousness. Now, this is a bit esoteric for those who have never been exposed to these thoughts, but we can relate it to many ordinary and everyday experiences. Feeling, almost always, in people's minds, is associated and, you might say, confused with emotion. Actually, feeling in the emotions is ruffled feeling. It's agitated feeling. And you can never, it's like a lake. If the surface of the lake is completely clear, you'll see the reflection of the moon in it. But if it's ruffled, you don't see one moon, you see lots of little things, and you can't really tell what the shape of that reflection is. And you may think that there are lots of little bits of shimmering light in the water itself. So your perception of reality is also disturbed by your feeling. People will get all excited. Look at the agitation, the violence that's occurred in Europe when they have had these football matches, soccer matches, as we call them here, not to confuse it with American football. But it's really amazing how a fad can sweep the country or a whole world. And people are absolutely convinced that this is what it is. People, after one of these mob scenes, may lynch somebody, convinced that he's an evil person. He may be perfectly innocent, but they get their feelings all aroused. And we're not living in islands, each one of us. We're all a part of a great sea. And what affects one is affecting everybody. And so if you let yourself get into that, you can get swept up in a mass emotion. And people who have been screaming for somebody to be lynched afterwards said, I don't know what got into me. Well, what got into them was that they didn't act from their own center. They allowed themselves to be swept along on a tide of popular emotion. Now, it's always emotion at the beginning of everything of this nature. Intellect is an armchair traveler. Intellect is an armchair philosopher. If you took men without women, you'd have a bunch of armchair philosophers. It's really women's energy that pushes them into action. And unfortunately, because women get emotional, the action too can be wrong. But if that energy is directed in the right way, supportively, if the male energy accepts it in the right way, appreciating it, if both directed towards superconsciousness, you can move the world. Just a few people in this world, being saints, being enlightened, living in that superconsciousness, have changed incredible things. Look at St. Francis, an absolutely marvelous example. I live near Assisi, where St. Francis lived. And so his vibration and consciousness and traditions are very strong there. But he was so deliberately poor. He didn't want any money. And this was an age when everybody thought money was it. And yet he was so magnetic, so full of something all of them wanted, which was joy, that he began attracting people by the hundreds and finally by the thousands. He changed really the course of the Catholic Church and of the Christian religion. One man, and an insignificant man at that, as far as social structure went. Yes, he was born into a wealthy home, but he renounced all that. You might say he had absolutely nothing going for him, except God. One time Yogananda was approached by somebody in America, in Los Angeles, and this person was looking around him superciliously. He said, "What are the assets of this organization?" Master said, "None, only God." That was a Franciscan answer. Our assets are God. Everything we have is God. You know that music last night? Sometimes I think, well, how did I ever write it? The answer is perfectly simple. I didn't. I don't want you to look in my room to see who the real person was. Because it's not a person. It's something that, and here's the secret, when you can take feeling and not allow it to get involved in emotion, listen to most music, it's almost always, if there's any feeling in it, it's emotional. That's what's wrong with it. Or it picks up on fads. It's of that time. But this music isn't of a time. It doesn't really reflect anything. But it's music that was born because the energy was directed upward. Now, if this became known as Kriyananda music, it would be a dead end. It would be a great pity. It isn't Kriyananda music. It's clarity music. When you can learn to direct your energy upward and draw from the superconsciousness, it'll get filtered through you. Yes, it's my music in that sense. It's who I am. But it's also it's that power which can come through all of you. If there's anything I've done, it's with the wish to inspire others to do it in their way. But to do it in their way means to open yourselves up to that and let it flow without feeling of emotional type, but deep intuitive feeling. Intuition comes when you turn the feeling inward and upward. Now, we've been attracting, thank God, more and more real artists. Wonderful singers, wonderful musicians. Some of the people who are associated with us who don't even live here, like Dana Anderson and Christy Norfleet and others, and then Bharat, who lives here. All of this comes basically from this same philosophy, clarity. You can feel it in the work they do. There's clarity there. It doesn't have to be our thing. It does not that we have to put it on. But if we've done anything in this world, I would like it to be to launch a whole new way of trying to do things. You have to be the doer in the sense, yes, because you have to filter it. And each person will be a different filter. But if we can filter it from a higher source, you'll find that you're bringing into this world a whole new state of consciousness. This is why I've written books on so many different subjects, to show how we can bring clarity into the fields of business and leadership and marriage and you name it. I've written all kinds of different subjects, always with this purpose. And it's always been trying to draw, because I'm a disciple. I don't want to do anything on my own, but I've tried to understand an aspect of Yogananda's teachings that I've come slowly to realize is really the aspect. It's what he came to do. He came to help launch this new age of energy in the right way, in the godly way. We can have energy. Sure, we can build bigger and better bombs. We can blow up more and more cities. That's not really doing much good. Well, maybe it is. I don't know. Sometimes I wonder. But no, I don't think so. I really think that what he came to do and his example which he gave, I was always so struck by the fact, you know, when I first came to Master, I was very much sort of the philosopher. And I enjoyed Bernard's talks more than Master's, because Bernard was very sort of Emersonian, and every sentence you felt was important. And Master, when he got out there, he wore his wisdom like a comfortable old jacket. And I loved it, but I couldn't quite grasp how very, very important this is. It seemed to me sort of a, It's like, well, because I try to be in tune with him and to act in his line, you might say. Years ago at the Zen Temple, they had a installation of the new Roshi, Richard Baker. And I went down there because he was a friend. And afterwards, I was talking to a few people, and there was a young lady, and I was talking with her, and she seemed interested, so we talked a little bit more, and I finally said to her, well, what's your name? And she told me. She said, well, what's yours? And I said, oh, Swami Kriyananda. Oh, but Kriyananda, but you're famous. And I said, well, maybe, I don't know, but why but? Why did you say but? And she said, well, most of the famous people I've ever met seem important. I've always loved that. I thought that was the best compliment I ever had. I remember being at a table. We were at this conference in Virginia, and I was one of the people. It was on communities. In fact, because it was on communities, and the founder of this thing was wanting to build a community himself, and he invited me, I was the only person there who actually had a community. All the others had thought about it. There was Peter Caddy there, but it's not a community that he built. It's more like a college that people stay for a while and go out. But there were several other people, Barbara Marx Hubbard, and I can't think of their names right now. Perhaps it's just as well. And so I invited all these teachers to dinner. And I was sort of amused. I was the host. They were talking to each other as if, well, we're important. They're totally ignoring me. I thought, I like this. I just don't want to be important. It's not important to be important. This is something I used to notice when I grew up in Romania, that some of the children of the executives of the Romano Americana, the Esso company there, would come over, and the children often had this attitude of importance. It seemed to be an American attitude. And I just used to wonder, what's so important about being important? Didn't make sense to me. And when I finally came to this country at the age of 13, it really put me off that so many of the boys were trying to throw their weight around and be big shots. And I just felt, well, that's not for me. But I was so happy to see that that was Yogananda's attitude too. He was so perfectly natural. And yet, everything he said was so true. And he, instead of trying, and this was one of the marvelous things about the way he taught, and I very quickly came to really appreciate it. It was just my first reaction. But I really came to appreciate how, in that simplicity, he was bringing truth to a level that we could relate to. He always put things in such a way as to make the average Joe Blow out there who doesn't know anything say, well, yeah, I've had that kind of experience. He didn't talk about these mystical things only, and yet an absolutely marvelous aspect of his teaching. Comparisons are odious, and I would not make a comparison in the sense of putting anybody down, but to show a contrast in his particular mission. I want to tell a story from Ramakrishna, who was a great master. I would never put anyone above a great master, any great master. Nonetheless, because Ramakrishna was there to talk about going within, and when he tried to describe the higher states of consciousness, he reached a point just about here when he couldn't speak anymore. Well, that's perfectly natural. When you go into super consciousness, you can't speak. You can't think in ordinary terms. And he was showing people that. So it's not to put him down, but it's to show an absolutely marvelous story about Yogananda, because nowhere in any mystical literature, anywhere, anytime, has anybody done what he did. That poem, Samadhi, going into that state and then being able, people don't realize what a fantastic feat that was, being able to bring that down to a level where he could verbalize it and make it seem thrilling and immediate to our consciousness. And he was telling us, monks there at Mount Washington one day, you ought to memorize that and recite it every day. So it'll keep in mind for you always what you're trying to achieve. Not to particularize your religion, but to universalize it in the whole universe. And he then said, you know where I wrote that? We, of course, said, no, where? He said, on the New York subway. I can't think of a more mundane environment in the world. I've been on those subway many a time and oft. People get on, sort of shut down, clamp down all the motors until they reach their destination, then go off. They sort of stare at each other, stare at the floor. Not an expression. He said that nobody, he said I went from one end of the line to the other, back and forth. He said nobody asked me for my ticket. Then he paused a moment, he smiled. He said, well, in fact, nobody saw me. But to be able to bring that high state down to a level where he could communicate it is what his mission was all about. It's not that Ramakrishna couldn't have, but that wasn't his mission. Yogananda's mission was to bring these marvelous things out of the ether, out of the clouds, down to a level where it can relate to mankind where we are right now. And that's what I've tried to do with my life as his disciple. I've tried to show how his teaching can be brought out into every phase of life. And he showed that, he gave us a clue in that too. He wrote a book on the laws of success. He wrote a book, The Scientific Healing Affirmation. In his lessons, he wrote rules for how to be a good employer and a good employee, how to be a happy and successful marriage partner. He wrote on many practical things, which you find that normally the saints don't. They're talking about how to get up there. He's talking about how to get there for those who want it, but he's also talking how to bring that there to here. He's talking how to make that spiritual life real. In other words, he was here to help raise the level of all of society. Well, one person, can he really do it? I saw a cartoon once. It was in Punch magazine in England many years ago. I don't think it exists anymore, but this was back in the 30s. And there was a series of three pictures. People all standing around at in a railway station. And all of them sort of sitting on their bags and leaning on their canes and talking to each other and nobody moving. Then the next picture, one person dashing madly in one direction. Third picture, everybody dashing after him. Suddenly think, oh my God, is my train leaving? It really, most people cancel each other out. They say it in the stock market, that if you own 5% of a stock, you own the company. Because most of the others, the other 95%, some vote for, some vote against. There's no real movement. And so just one person with 5% impulse in one direction can change the whole direction. In the revolution of the Bolsheviks in Russia, it took just 5% of the populace to create that revolution. It may have been a disaster, but nonetheless, that's what made it happen. And you will find that this is true generally in the whole world. Most people are too interested in their wives and children, job and so on. They don't much care what happens. Very few people think in these terms. But when you get one person who's really dedicated to one thing, he can change the world. You can't do it much in the ballot box, but you can do it by influence. That's why a president, even though he's only one man, has more power because he gets to be heard. And he is usually gets up there because he's got convictions. And it takes conviction. Now, if we can be, just a small group as we are, if we can really be devoted and convinced, committed to the concept of being clear, of bringing clarity to our lives and to life, and to understand that clarity doesn't mean that, oh, I used to go absolutely crazy when I was a young man. I wanted something that would move me. And I'd say something to somebody about how this needs changing or something. And, well, I don't know. I got so fed up with that attitude, sort of sitting on a fence and not doing anything. I'd rather do something wrong than nothing. At least if I do something wrong, I'll quickly find out it was wrong and go in a better direction. Whereas sitting on a fence isn't going to get you anywhere. So what I have tried with my life and what Master tried, and that's why I really was enthrilled with meeting him, commitment to something, for God's sake. But how can you be committed to just making money? Oh, sure, you can be, but what have you got in the end? Ulcers. It's just not worth it. So many people, the vast majority of people, if they're really dedicated, are dedicated to something absolutely trivial. And unfortunately, that's the case in the arts. You will see in the arts in the last 100 years and more that people are always into impressionism, cubism, abstractions of some kind. What's the word? I'm trying to think of it. Come on, you know. Anyway, the isms. My mind isn't on isms, but it's I'm certainly aware of them. And I remember my aunt, she was actually quite a successful artist. And when her husband died, she moved from Oklahoma to Paris. Completely goofy, but really a good artist. And she asked me, "Which do I like, surrealism or don't I?" Because she was trying to learn about surrealism at that time. And I said, "I don't much care if it's surrealism or non-surrealism. It isn't the ism, it's the understanding behind it." As I was telling you last night, that simple line in that logo of Ananda, which I did so many times before I could really get what I had seen in my meditation, which gave a sense of joy. How does that sort of a curve give joy? I don't know, but it did. It does. That's what surrealism does, and it can be valid. But usually it's not. Usually it's an ego game. People get their ego into it, and they like to feel that because nobody understands what they're doing, they're in a position above them. They're precious, and in their understanding, they have something sensitive that others lack. Well, the heck with that noise. If you can't really feel it, you've got to get it clear. I love to give my manuscripts to people and have them say, well, this point isn't quite clear. And I look at it, and my first reaction, because after all, everybody's dedicated to something he's really slaved over, my first reaction is, wait a minute. But I think, no, let them speak. Let me hear them. And very often, by no means always, I don't want you to think that I'm just absolutely going to go any way people tell me. I measure it in myself. But very often I'll see, wait, that's right, it's not quite clear. So I'll work to make it clearer. Don't let other people rule you. Don't be ruled by their opinions. But take what they say, listen to what they say, ask for them to say it. And when you hear it, weigh it in yourself. Because you know there are many rights and wrongs. There are many ways of doing even one thing. And many times people will say, why not do it this way, why not do it that way, when you don't feel it in yourself. But if you consult your feelings, that's where your real understanding comes. It's not enough to think, does it make sense? It's got to feel right. When you feel, and how do you know whether it feels right? I mean, a lot of people in the world of art, that's their big thing, feeling. Oh, it feels good. In what way does it feel good? You got that feeling? No. Does it feel in tune? When you offer it up to the inner silence, Is there a resonance that way? This is a very difficult point to get across. I don't know how to do it verbally, but I hope you can understand it intuitively, as I've had to. I have found that if I want to understand a thing, for example, a song, because that's been my thing, and I must say I think that of all the arts, music is the most immediate because it's a direct transferal of consciousness. You can feel in music things that you can't feel in visual arts, although they are a wonderful method and medium also, but you can feel it. Words in a book are so frustrating because you can get the ideas across, but how do you get the feeling? That's the difference between lecturing and writing. I love writing because you can make a point so clear. You can say exactly what you mean. You can't do it when lecturing. If you want to do it, you have to write it out, and then there's no feeling. The beautiful thing about lecturing as a medium is that it's a communication of consciousness. And so I never prepare because I want to tune in to people and talk to them where their minds are, their questions. This is something you can only do if, however, you've got to go within and feel your own center. Now, that's not enough to feel your center. You've also got to feel the other person's center. You know, Yogananda was marvelous in this example. When he was with somebody, in a sense, in a very real sense, he became that person. You see, there was no personality in him because he had no likes and dislikes. His feelings were absolutely clear. There was no habit structure. Dr. Lewis said that he did everything for the first time as if there was no habit guidance. Well, that's not possible. That's not true. But he wasn't guided by his habit. He allowed habit to help. Habit is, as Yogananda put it, a convenient mechanism of the mind to save you the exercise of initial willpower in an undertaking. When I first learned to tie my shoelaces at the age of 5, it was a big project. Just, you know, it was big. I had to put all my concentration on it. Now I can tie my shoelaces and talk to somebody. It's simple. Habits are very important. You need them. But Yogananda was so clear that there was no prejudice. For one thing, you knew he was your friend. But you knew he was your friend because in a deeper way, you knew he was you. And I would see him with other people. He would be reflecting them. And I saw this in him with everybody. He became that person. Now, I don't mean that when he became that person was angry, he became angry. That person was jealous, he became jealous. Nothing like that. It was really, I would put it this way, that it was this, if he were that person's higher consciousness looking down at that person. He was what that higher aspect of that person was. He was reflecting that so that if somebody was angry, he would have a look in his eyes that would make that person say, I shouldn't be. And that's how he taught you. He didn't teach you much through words. Sure, he had to speak, and he did speak, but there are great yogis who don't ever speak. And most of his real teaching wasn't through speaking. You know, I'd been with him a year about, and he put me in charge of the monks. And I organized the monks. They had never been organized since 1925, and this was 1949. It just wasn't his thing, but I took it seriously. And he never told me. He never said, "Now sit down, Walter. I want to explain to you. He didn't give me that kind of a blueprint. You hear that expression, blueprint. Nothing like that. There was no such blueprint. He himself said the blueprint is in the ether. But when I did something right, he would show approval. When I did it wrong, he would gently correct it. Basically, I didn't do it wrong, but he sort of led me. But it was by thought. I would ask him, "Well, what should I do?" And I'd know what to do. This is how an artist should be. That when he tries to tune into something, don't paint it just the way you want to blurt yourself out onto the world. Go into your center and then try to tune into the center of whatever it is you're trying to express. Now, how do I explain things like that? And yet, it's a fact. It's something I've lived and I know it's so. But a realism attitude. You can never paint realistically. Nature does it for you. You can't do it that way. You can paint a brick wall. It'll still be different from the brick wall your eyes see. Because he's a filter. Anything you do with your consciousness is going to be done as a filter for whatever you see. And you will see that two so-called realists painting the same brick wall will see it differently. You can't be a totally realistic painter. You might as well face it and accept. But to try to be realistic in your attitude, yes, I think that's good. Impressionism is marvelous. But on the other hand, it shouldn't be your projection only onto the world. There should be a rapport. So when somebody was looking at some pictures of mine that I took in Hawaii, I thought it was a very perceptive comment that she made. She said, I felt that the flowers were responding to your love for them. And they did look different from other pictures of flowers. I was projecting that kind of feeling. Now, I don't know how it works. I couldn't begin to give you any scientific thing. But I can say that something does seem to happen. When you try to do anything, do it consciously. That's what we've got to learn to do. Be conscious of what we're doing. Do it with the consciousness, not of, I mean, most people's consciousness is, how can I cheat this guy? How can I get what I want for myself out of him? That's not what I mean. Project your consciousness into the world and let it be a sort of echo. It'll be different. What you see and what other people see will be different because that same superconscious will be filtered differently through each one of us. That's why I don't want my music to be the end of this. I'd like it to spark a whole new movement in art to the extent that I'm able to, so that people don't say, oh, that was a great man. I mean, who am I? I'm nobody. I think God chose me to write this music just because he needed a real dodo. Somebody who hadn't studied music, who I don't know the rules. There are millions of people more sensitive musically, but I do know what I'm saying, and I know it's right. And it may not be right for you. You may find another way of doing it, but I think God has chosen me in these ways to help express something that all of you will begin to say, yes, I could do that too. Now, if I were somebody who was an absolute genius in that, you might say, well, it's an impossible act to follow. I don't want that to be true. People were saying that about my music even now. I know it's good. I know it says what I want, and I know that what I want is something real. I know that what I felt is real. I'm happy with it. It's not that I feel at all deprecating about it, but do I feel it's the dead end? Absolutely not. That's just me. Who am I? You can do that. Express it in your way, but do it in this way. Express yourself. That's all you've got to do. Listen, you're stuck with you. I remember when I went to Mexico in 1945, I realized that what I'd been looking for was not there because I was stuck with the same old me. And I had been whipping up this sense of great adventure. It turned out that the one missing link, the one drag on the whole scene was the fact that I was there. And I remember I came back in the movie, the Razor's Edge had just come out, and there were a group of us. I was at Brown University then. I transferred from Haverford. And there was a girl at the table who had seen the movie, and she said, oh, I would just love to go to India and get lost. And I laughed, and I said, whom would you lose? You would lose everything, but the only thing you would like to lose. You can never get away from yourself. You might as well make friends with yourself. But yourself is not this ego and desires and all these things that the only person I've met, apart from other saints, who really was himself was Yogananda. He was himself, although he was not a personality. But there was something, God said something and sang a different song through him and sang it purely. God has a song to sing through each one of you, through every human being, through every atom. He has a different thing to say. When people say, well, but St. Francis was like this, why aren't you like this? That was St. Francis. That was Master's answer. That was the way God played through him. One time Master said to Sri Yukteswar, I think he was comparing his work with Ramakrishna's work, but some master of their time, and Master was making a comparison. Sri Yukteswar said, why do you make comparisons? This is how God is playing through you and me. Our work is unique. It doesn't mean it's the only or the best. It's itself. It's trying to express clarity. Yes, that is a special mission, because I don't see clarity anywhere. It just amazes me to see how much unclarity there is in just about every direction I look. That perhaps is our mission, to bring clarity of the heart, not just the head, to bring these two together. But once we've brought it, people can use their own clarity. It's not something that, oh, at Ananda they're clear. No, that clarity should be something that everybody can get into. It doesn't have to be, oh, we've got to do it their way. You know, when we went to Sorrento for the first time, there was this group there that were singing songs, chants with the guitar. And I thought, that's a great medium. The trouble with the harmonium is that I noticed that people would get slower and slower and slower. There was no way I could beef them up. No way I could get a little speed and rhythm into it. I tried with a little grace notes and so on, but how do you manage it? You can do it maybe with a tabla, but there aren't that many people who play the tabla well. And besides, it doesn't fit our chanting system. It's more of an Indian rhythm. And I noticed that with their guitar, there was a rhythm that your whole crowd could follow. So that whereas playing the chants on my own in my own room, I can have any rhythm I like. I used to love to listen to Master when he sang that song, Blue Lotus Feet. Divine Mother, my Divine Mother. And he would just sort of hold the note forever. Divine Mother, my Divine Mother. You know, it came from the heart. But you can't do it in a group. I mean, you're doing it from your heart and everybody, oh, you've got to have a certain rhythm to it. Guitar did that wonderfully. And so it's great for some kinds of chanting. And I brought it back here. I said, let's use the guitar. And people were saying, we've never used the guitar. We don't do it with the guitar. There was a lot of rebellion at this novelty that I was importing. But it made sense, and so we do use it now. And my thought was, okay, so we don't do it. Master didn't do it. But it's in tune with what he did. And he, too, used to like to use rhythm. I know he had the tablas, and he would sing with the tablas. And Dr. Lewis, who was a Boston dentist and sort of very old-fashioned, and he sort of winced when Master would play these drums. And Master said, get into it, doctor. It loosens the chakra. It loosens the karma in the spine. And he was all for strong rhythm. He was a great drummer, too. I would see him sitting there sometimes just waiting for something to happen, whatever, and his hands would be going like this. It wasn't restlessness. It wasn't just fiddling. He was sort of hearing a little rhythm in his head and playing as you would on the tabla, on the drums. This is just an example of how you want to get to the essence of what you're trying to do. It isn't that we do it this way. It's this that we're trying to do in any way that'll work. And that's what Master was trying to do with his teachings. He was trying to show how they can work on all levels. That's what I've tried to do with his books. I don't want these to become the definitive expressions of anything. That's why I've made them so brief, so that others will take these thoughts and expand them in other directions, so that each one will be like a seed that will begin to finally produce a forest. Because what we want to do is see a change in people. They're not going to change if they have to keep doing it your way. Each one has his own song to sing. And this is what art should be here to lead the way in. In religion, okay, that's the most important thing of all. After that, I think it's the arts. When Van Gogh lived, Padma, did I get that one right? She's Dutch, so she tells me how to pronounce Dutch properly, and you won't even know what I meant when I said it. Van Gogh. When he lived, he was a great artist. Yeah, he went crazy like so many of the people in the 19th century because there was too much emphasis on self, but still he was wonderful. You know that in his lifetime, he probably made not more than $15 with his paintings. He had to always be supported by his brother. There were a lot of people in his town who must have thought this man's a wastrel because he's not making money. But look at his work today, one painting for millions. Money isn't the real criterion. Artists don't seem to make a great impact, and unfortunately, they try to be different. They try to show themselves different, dressing in rags and so on. It's not necessary. You don't have to prove that you're something special. You shouldn't try to be anything special. You should try to be human. What's lacking in the human nature is the heart, and that's what art should be, is to help people bring the heart, bring feeling, but intuitive feeling, not likes and dislikes and emotions and anger. Look how much art is full of anger. It's a downer. I wouldn't want most of that kind of painting hanging in my house. There's one man in Capri that... I know a lot of you think that should be pronounced Capri. It's not. It's Capri. You wear capris. Anyway, he had a painting there in his shop, and I liked that painting. It had a good feeling to it, but it was more expensive than I thought I could afford, so I went home, but I kept thinking, gee, that was a nice painting. So when I went back there a year or two later, I tried to get that painting. Well, of course, it had been sold. But he had other paintings, and I bought 40 of his paintings, and quite a few Ananda people have different ones of his paintings, too. But you know something about the man? He was a sweet man. He painted his nature into his work. It was perfectly ordinary work, just views. But there was a nice vibration. This is what you put into your art. I remember he heard that I was a vegetarian. Oh, I'd never heard of vegetarians. And he thought this was a great idea. And he was talking to me and he said, no meat. No, no meat. Fish? No, no, no fish. He had a big joke about this, but it was great fun being with him. He was a charming person and just an ordinary person. He wasn't showing himself off as the artist. He had lots of great exhibitions in different cities of Europe and Italy, but he didn't show himself off that way. Really good people don't have to show themselves to be good. And so what you find in a work of art is the person. He can't avoid that. That's the one thing you can never get away from. But it should be the real person. That real person is, you see, in spiritual writings you find again and again, get rid of the ego. That's the one thing you can't get rid of, for God's sake. It doesn't seem like a fair thing to try to insist that you get rid of the only thing you can never get away from. But the truth is that you've got to understand that the self is an infinite. As Yogananda wrote in that beautiful poem, Samadhi, I, everywhere, all-flowing I, everywhere. That sense of I is at the heart of every atom. He put that sense of I into each individual life, and it propagates itself. It isn't as if God had to create every tree. He created the model, and every tree has to create itself. And people think, well, I've made these children, there's reflections of me. And what a lot of disappointed parents there are. because children come like invited guests into your home. They've got their own karma to work out. They've got their own lives to live. And each one goes in his own different direction. I think of my poor dad. Oh, God. I was so different from what he expected, what he could have possibly expected. He never quite got over it. But there it is. I had to be me. I couldn't be a reflection of his values. He wanted me to be an engineer. Well, you can think of me as an engineer. I can't. It just... Each one has to be himself. Let your children be themselves. Encourage them to be themselves. Don't try to make them mirror images of you. Try to teach them in such a way that they can learn their own skill. It's sort of like when I... Oh, God, look at the time. I have so much I'd like to tell you. So I won't tell that story. Never mind. You've got to get... What you have to get understand is that the ego is the limited self. It's that infinite self implanted in you, thinking it's your little body and personality. But that's not you. You are that infinite. And you don't get rid of the ego. You expand that sense of self to suddenly realize it's everywhere. And this is what Yogananda did with people, that he became those people because he was those people. I was with him one time. We were walking out at the desert, his desert retreat, and he had his hand on my arm for support because he was really in such a state of inwardness that he sometimes would almost seem ready to fall. And once I had to almost catch him, and he said, "You know, I'm in so many bodies, it's hard for me to know which one I'm supposed to keep moving." One time he said to somebody, "You have a sour taste in your mouth, don't you?" And she said, "Well, how do you know?" He said, "Because I'm as much in your body as I am in this one." Well, that seems like an outrageous statement, or like a beautiful poetic statement, but not a true one. Anybody can say it, but my gosh, he proved it in so many ways to me. I'll never forget how many times he would tell me things that I had been thinking in the privacy of my own meditation room, in the privacy of my own mind, things that he wanted me to do differently. And I know one time I had been trying, because somebody was attacking the things I represent. He was a skeptic and a materialist, and he was sort of putting it all down as just ridiculous superstition. So I tried to bring in a few things that I'd seen with my own eyes, and he just thought I was crazy. When I saw Master next, he said, "When you're with people who are cynics, skeptics, materialists, don't talk about miracles." I said, "You knew?" He was hundreds of miles away. How could he know? I said, "You knew?" He said, "I know every thought you think." How could he know that? It's because he was me. Now, it doesn't mean that as if I sort of felt a little crowded in there. I mean... There's another self in all of us, and that self is the same self as all. If everybody in this world were suddenly to go into samadhi, it wouldn't suddenly become crowded on another level. It's where you really are and you don't know it. That superconscious is what we've all come down from. That infinite self is stuck in this little definition of what it thinks it is. You think you are what you have done in your life. You aren't that at all. If you're a man, you could easily be a woman. If you're a Frenchman, you could easily be an American. All these different things are really manifestations of the same truths, but each one is particularized. And in that, God wants, he never repeats himself. No two thumbprints are alike. That's the wonderful thing about his creation. It's just, it boggles the mind. Everything is unique. Every moment is unique. And what you have to say, if you can get rid of these thoughts of who you think you ought to be and get down to who you really are, and you can only do that if you can get rid of your likes and dislikes, get rid of your desires, get into your inner feeling, let your feelings go inward so that if you see something that really upsets you, like I was in a lawsuit recently and people were hurling outrageous accusations against me, and there was nothing I could do. I knew there was nothing I could do, but I didn't. I thought, why get excited? I just thought there's only one thing nobody can take away from me. That's myself and my love for God. So I sat there through all this big show. I know one time I was asked to say something. I tried to speak. He said, oh, yes, Mr. Walters, we know you like to be eloquent. What are you going to do? I just thought, nobody can take this away from me. Nobody can take away my love for God. Nobody can take away myself. Now, that's who you are, too. Don't let other people's opinions, don't let other people's judgments, don't let other people's praise, don't let likes and dislikes in yourself influence your feeling, when you can just decide, no, that's not me. I'm not a part of that. Be centered in yourself and turn that energy upward. That's when you will be who you are. And everything that you do will be unique. Nobody could write my kind of music. I couldn't write your kind of music. But what I'm saying is find your kind of music. And I don't say it's got to be music in the sense of a melody. When I say that God has a different song to sing through every human being, song is vibration. Action is vibration. Everything you do is a vibration, and to that extent it's music. So you can be a businessman. You can be a president. You can be a housekeeper. You can be a teacher. You can be so many things, but do it in your way. And that means not consulting too much how other people have done it. Go into yourself and think, well, how do I feel? This has been, I have to say, to my good fortune, a tendency in me that has driven other people absolutely crazy. Because people will, this would be back when I was a child even, they'd come to me with perfectly logical reasons for things, and I wouldn't be convinced. I'd say, in my mind, I'd say, I need to feel it. They'd just absolutely go wild. Why can't you see it? No, I have to feel it. When I did, I'd do it. But why do it until I feel it? Why do anything until you feel it inside? That's how you'll know what you should do in life, not what other people tell you to do. I'm not trying to convert you to anything except to yourself. Yes, I'm trying to do that. Get to know yourself. Not that person you see in the mirror when you look and sort of shudder. I hope not. There's another you that when you can strip away all these things, you know, that's the difference between yoga practice and an ordinary education. Yoga practice doesn't add, it subtracts. It says, I'm not this and I'm not that, I'm not. And you find bit by bit, the more you take away, the more you see that you are something. You can't define it particularly, but there's a reality. Every song that I've written has a meaning, and I couldn't begin to tell you what most of them mean. Because meaning doesn't have to be something you can reduce to a verbal formula, but it's a feeling. For example, I'll just give you a little one. An example I've used before, it's that song Cloisters. I did a slideshow, and I found it very helpful to make music based on these slideshows because they're a focal point. And I need a focal point to know what I'm trying to say. So there was in this Amalfi in Sorrento area, there was a church, but a church, a monastery in a church. But it was a monastery that's no longer an active monastery. It's a place where people used to worship, and now tourists go there. And I wanted to bring in this, I had a slide of this, and I wanted to show the monastery and the church feeling there. And so I wanted a feeling that would be church-like in the traditional sense because this was Italy. So naturally that feeling brought to my mind the Gregorian chant. And so it had to be in that mode. I didn't want to bring in some new kind of thing. It had to be in that mode. But then I thought, mind you, this is all before I even began thinking of melody. Then I thought, but this monastery is now a tourist place, so it can't be too traditional. It's got to have the modern consciousness too, the people who come in and perhaps feel inspired by it, but don't feel drawn to it. And so there was that. And it can't be too much of that, or it would get away from the devotion. And so with those simple thoughts, I just held those thoughts clearly in my mind and held them up to my superconscious. And I said, give me a melody that says that. Instantly it came, no problem. Long I've called you, my Lord, long I've called you. Many years I have longed for your sight. Very Gregorian in feeling. Then suddenly it wanted to change. Bathe the darkness in tears, with tears of devotion. Now that tears is not Gregorian. It gets out of that mold. It's a more modern feeling to it. Bathe the darkness in with tears of devotion. Offered candles in prayer to your light. And then, having been raised here, that thought came into my mind, and I had to say, no, you have to control it, because modern music is emotional. And so the thought that since I wanted to be more modern naturally brought the impulse to go beyond that into an emotional, how much longer, friend? And I knew that's not what I wanted, so I pulled it back. How much longer, friend, must I cry your name? Must I cry your name? You see, that controls it. The feeling's a lot deeper because there's emotion there for sure. It wanted to say, how much longer, but it wouldn't, because I knew that would be emotional. It wouldn't be feeling. So to keep the feeling there, you have to control your feeling. Don't let it get out of hand. How much longer, friend, must I cry your name? I am yours, ever yours. Now, this is a spiritual song. It's a song to God. And so it can't end the way an ordinary song does. The rules of music are that you end on a tonic. So the natural rule of singing in a melody like this would be to say, I am yours, ever yours, will you come? Isn't that so? All music ends that way normally. It couldn't. This is a song offered to God. It's got to go off into infinity. And so I didn't even have to work for it. I knew it was later that I had to analyze to understand what my superconscious was doing. It wasn't that I had to say I had to control it. I just understood afterwards that's why it had controlled it. But at the end, I am yours, ever yours. Will you come? And you see, it goes off into infinity. It doesn't end. When I wanted to write the Canticle of the Creatures of St. Francis, I'd wanted for years to write a melody for that song, but I couldn't think how to do it because it's so totally unorthodox as far as any songwriting goes. One stanza, a line, will be 5 syllables. In another one, the same stanza will be 25 syllables. You can't write a melody that way. And so I always sort of had to give up and didn't think about it. Then I was writing a slideshow for the life of St. Francis because I'd taken a lot of pictures of Assisi. And I thought, well, I can't write a slideshow for St. Francis and not write a melody for his most famous lyrics, said to be the first poem in the Italian language. So I was sitting at my desk, and the desk was in another room now where Sean and Uma live, as those of you who know Crystal Hermitage know. And I came into the living room where my piano is, absolutely certain that by the time I got there, I would have the melody. I did. By the time I reached the piano, I knew. Because what I had done is visualize St. Francis ill, blind, standing by a tree when he was supposed to be on his deathbed. And Sister Claire came down expecting to see him just totally laid out. And there he was, full of joy. He said, God has just given me this beautiful song. Listen. And he sang this song to them. And I visualized that scene and I said, give me that melody. It was there and it was perfect. Ask God to tell you, he will. Is it the melody St. Francis wrote? I don't know. But it sure fits. You know that thing that you heard last night with that beautiful violin and cello? That was only a part of a segment there. But I'd written a slideshow. I'd done a slideshow called Different Worlds. And I didn't want lots of different melodies for the different kinds of consciousness and people I was showing. I wanted one melody that expressed the human state. I thought, that's impossible. All the grief, the sorrow, the joy, the disappointment, the fulfillment, everything. Just the human state. What man goes through. How do you do that? I just couldn't. But one day, I had a cook up in my kitchen. My home was very different then. The kitchen was in the same room as the dome. She was from Australia, Patria, and she was cooking for me. My little piano, I didn't have the larger piano then, was down below. And I thought, before I went downstairs to my room, let me just sit and see if God will give me a melody. I put my fingers on the keys and said, okay, give me a melody. And I just let my fingers, now this was not automatic writing kind of thing. I cooperated with something I was feeling. But that melody came out. And I remember her, Patria, up there, said, it's perfect for Different Worlds. It is. And I think you must have felt something of that. This, mind you, it doesn't always have to be, and this is why I like the idea of clarity. It would be beautiful to use soul music. Can't do it. Higher consciousness, higher self, maybe. But how do you figure? One time I wanted to write, I did another one of Romania. Now, when I was a child in Romania, Dracula was not a legend. It was written by the wife of Percy Bysshe Shelley. But Dracula in Romanian means devil. Safir al Dracula means go to the devil. We didn't know those legends. But anyway, I thought, heck, I'm doing this slideshow for Americans, so let me throw Dracula into the mix. And so I needed a melody for Dracula. I couldn't think of it. My mind doesn't go in that direction. So again, I asked God to give me this melody. Now listen, you would not expect God to give you a melody about a villain like Dracula, would you? It came instantly. Bum, 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 bum. And it was perfect. But I didn't do it. It was just there. It was given to me. Most of what I've done has come that way. Not quite that automatically, but almost always I've asked for it and put myself in tune with that and got from my center to that center of what it was I was trying to do, and it was there. God has so many songs to sing. Let him do it. Give the guy a chance. Don't say, I want this, I want that. I've never done a melody think I want the melody to go this way, or I want it to go that way. I've thought, what do you want? What does it itself want? Get to the heart of the melody itself. What does it want to say? You'll see that in any field, people who are good at what they do, they're doing what I'm telling you. They may be businessmen, they may not be able to verbalize what I'm talking about, but they'll go to the heart of it. I knew a man in Detroit. He was a Jew. He was a very successful businessman, and his business was making Christmas cards. He had an absolute sense for which will work and which won't work. And as a result, he was successful. Just like Luther Burbank. He just knew, because he could get to the center of that. This may make absolutely no sense to you, but I hope it makes some sense, because it works. If you can get into your own self, if you can feel your own center, and tune in to whomever you're trying to help. Tune in to whatever you're trying to say. Tune into the center of what you're trying to understand. You'll be amazed at how well you can do it. You know, I told you yesterday, I'm not into rock and roll music at all. But there was this one, what's his name?
Michael Jackson.
I wouldn't listen to him if you gave me on a platter. It just isn't for me. But I was exposed to some of this music and I listened. And I was absolutely amazed. He is good. I don't like it. But what he's trying to say, he's saying. He's doing it because he's completely in tune with what he's doing. And when I met, what's his name, the founder of the farm?
Stephen Gaskin.
I met him in Montreal at a conference there. Well, you know, the man was an English teacher. He knows good English. He deliberately was speaking hip language, which to me is sort of offensive. I mean, I believe in good English, and I think we ought to not try to bastardize our own language. He was totally into rock music because he felt it had great energy. In other words, he was really into things that I'm really not into, and in some cases, really anti in a sense. I absolutely loved the man because he was genuine. Whoever you are, don't think it's got to be this or it's got to be that. Be yourself. We had a great communication. Because he was himself. This is who he was. It's not who I am. Who am I to say he should be something else? I don't ask you to be like me. I ask you to be true to yourself. If you want to help this world, be that. And the greatest thing that can do it is the arts. Because the arts deliberately try to express feeling. Express the right feeling, for God's sake. We've got too much of this absolutely dark stuff in this world. Try to express that which you can offer to your superconscious and know what God really is trying to say through you. We can flood the world with so much beauty, so much inspiration. This is what will change the world. Yogananda couldn't do it alone, but that power that he brought that I've tuned into, and I know it's his power. This is a power that's like a great wave. It can change you. In the bargain, it can change the world. How much better than political détente and all those things. Bring God into this world, but bring it in the way Yogananda did. Not just how can we get up to God, but how can we bring God into everybody's life? How can we make him real in life? How can we bring clarity to life? Clarity should be our deliberate attempt to offer the world what we can. The clearer we are, above all in feeling, the more everything you do will change other people. Okay.